Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. Today, you'll hear Seth's interview with activist Jose Antonio Vargas. Then Seth chats with author Tommy Orange, who also takes a few more questions backstage at Studio AG. Now let's get to the show.
Our guest is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and founder of the nonprofit Define American. He's also the author of Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. Please welcome to the show, Jose Antonio Vargas.
Thank you for having me.
I really appreciate you making the time. So you have been an undocumented person for 25 years.
Yes.
And
yes.
When you wrote your book that won the Pulitzer, you said Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. Why was it important for you to have citizen in the title?
Well, actually, I ended up winning the Pulitzer when I was a reporter for the Washington Post.
Gotcha.
It's not for the book, but thank you.
No, I feel like you were overlooked.
It was overlooked.
For the book, and I'm going to make a big point of it next time I talk to my friend Bob Pulitzer.
You gotta love America, though. Like, I can ended up winning a part of a Pulitzer, but I can't get a green card.
Yeah.
Right? So there's no process for undocumented immigrants like me who have lived here 26 years next month to actually legalize our status and follow a process. Actually, I was watching the debate tonight, and I actually started thinking that, you know, coming on the show, I want to actually make an announcement. I think after tonight, I am deciding to run for president of the United States of America.
All right, yeah.
Yes.
Why not?
On behalf of all the undocumented immigrants in the country, I'm totally kidding. Totally kidding. Because, well, the reality is undocumented immigrants like me can't even vote for an election, much less participate.
You showed up when you were 12 years old from
the Philippines.
And you did not realize until you were 16 and tried to get a driver's license that you lacked documentation. Is that how it worked out?
That was in 1997. Uh-huh. You know, only 13 states allow undocumented immigrants to drive. So I found out when I was 16, and, you know, there was no Google. It's not like I can Google this. And I'm Filipino. And whenever the media said anything about illegal people, it was always about Mexico. Right. By the way, if you see an Asian-looking person with a Latino name, it means they're Filipino. It's a little hint from me to you. There's 4 million of us in America. So I thought I may be the only non-Mexican undocumented immigrant in this country. Then thankfully, I was a student at Mountain View High School, and my teacher, Mrs. Doerr, said, I asked too many annoying questions, and I should do this thing called journalism. And then I found out that when you become a journalist, you get a byline. So, like, your name is on a piece of paper. So I thought, if I can't be here because I don't have the right papers, what if my name is on the paper?
Yeah.
Like, this book actually has a Library of Congress number. Like, I don't have a green card, but the book is documented, and I'm not.
That's all right.
But what is that about, right? Like, and actually for me, now that immigration is, like, the central topic in this election, I think there's an opportunity for us to really educate people about what the issue is and what really a lot of the politicians and even people in the mainstream media is not really talking about.
What are they getting wrong? When you watch, when you read coverage about it, when you watch a debate like tonight, what do you feel like people are getting wrong when they talk about the immigration debate?
Well, I mean, the number one thing is the fact that there is no the number one question I get asked all the time is, why can't you just get legal? As if all I have to do is like flip a switch and poof, I'm an American stealing your welfare, right? And even tonight during the debate, you know, when they talked about undocumented immigrants and healthcare, like undocumented workers like me actually contribute billions of dollars in taxes and Social Security. Like, I have paid so much taxes this past tax season, I should be a Republican.
Yeah.
Right? So we pay into the tax, we pay into the system that deports and detains us. Like, so what is that about? And the fact is, in the media, even now, I'm really sorry to say this, even the Washington Post and the New York Times still refer to people like me as illegal. So Define American has actually been at the forefront of actually challenging how news organizations and then how television shows portray immigrants like me.
And talk about Define American and when you started it, and obviously those are a couple of the goals, but how you go about trying to get people to listen.
Well, to be honest, I'm only one story, right? Like, there's... If I counted all the undocumented white people that I meet at Starbucks...
That's where they would hang out.
That's where they would hang out. And they tell me they're undocumented. And usually we don't talk about undocumented white immigrants or even undocumented black immigrants from Africa or the Caribbean. The reality is the fastest growing undocumented population are coming from Asia, not from Latin America. I actually think we owe the Mexican people an apology for having made this issue just about Mexican people and just about Latin America. Mm-hmm. Right? There's like 56 million Latin people in this country, and the majority of them have been here for decades, if not centuries. Like, I don't know, when California used to be part of Mexico. So to me, what we're really, our goal is, how do we get people to get this issue out of this border Mexican box that we have locked it in? And for us, storytelling is the way to do that. So if you're undocumented and you want to share your story, if you're white, black, if you're an engineer or if you're a farmer, go to our website, defineamerican.com, and tell us your story. And help us get this issue out of this box that we have relegated it in.
Well, I'm so glad you're doing that. Thank you so much for making the time tonight.
So
it is just great to talk to anybody about this issue, especially you. Jose Antonio Vargas, everybody, be right back. Our next guest is a very talented writer whose critically acclaimed debut novel, There, There, is available in paperback. Please welcome to the show, Tommy Orange, everyone. How are you?
I'm nervous.
You're nervous? You have no reason to be nervous, but you've had an incredible year. This novel was a finalist for the Pulitzer, many other awards, but probably, I'm assuming, one of the most jarring things to your reality was President Obama made a list of his favorite things of last year, and he put this book on the list. How quickly did you hear from people that that had happened?
I'd heard from my agent that he had the book. So I was sort of nervous about the idea that I wouldn't make it, even though it seems presumptuous to think that I would make it.
Right.
But I knew that it was a possibility. So when it happened, I was pleasantly, you know, I reference him in the book.
Yeah.
One of the characters says, I'm as native as Obama is black. And, you know, the fact that he referenced it in his list was a big affirmation.
It's pretty amazing that he's such a big deal that you hear he has your book. Like, just word gets out that, like, hey, the book has made it to the president.
Yes.
And you didn't, I'm sorry, you didn't make Donald Trump's favorite list of books.
How, it was like two books?
It was
that?
Two books.
One?
It was The Art of the Deal and
it's
a
his
map.
Own.
Yeah, he said a map. This is an incredible book. It's sort of 12 disparate characters who sort of find their way to this powwow. And was it difficult keeping sort of 12 very unique, very well-drawn characters separate in your writing process?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, it was intensely difficult to... Why I took it on as a project, I'm not sure now. It's something I decided a long time ago. To try to make everyone organically seem to come together at the end was something that that I struggled with a great deal. And I had many more than 12 characters. And so to find the ones that felt like they were true and real to the world that I knew in Oakland, it was definitely... a trying process.
And for your first novel, did you ever think to yourself, maybe if I'd written a few more, I wouldn't have made the first one this hard? Like, this was, were you like, this is such a rookie mistake to have done it like this?
There's a lot of rookie mistakes that I did in the novel that, that maybe somebody, if somebody would have warned me, I wouldn't have done it. But I was mostly self-taught until I got into an MFA program. The design, by the time I got into the program, was already I was too deep in to change it.
You couldn't back out of it at that point.
Yeah.
You, it's based, There is based on a Gertrude Stein quote about Oakland, which is, there is no there there. Explain what she was saying with the quote and why you wanted to make that the title of this book.
So I was researching other Oakland authors to try to figure out who else talked about Oakland in literature. And there was Gertrude Stein and Jack London. Jack London wrote about the wild, and Gertrude Stein wrote about not writing about Oakland. So there's very little to go on as far as, like, how do I write about Oakland? And but her quote was talking about how she left Oakland after her childhood there and came back, and the land that she grew up on was developed over and unrecognizable. And I can't say that I was a big Gertrude Stein reader. I just came across it researching this book, and the resonances for the Native experience in regards to the sort of unrecognizable connection to land, and a book about Native people and how they experience their environment and what it means to be Native in a city, it all just felt very potent for a title and for... It took me a while to land at there, but it all was just very layered resonances within the Native experience.
And again, you talk about the Native experience and the importance of putting this book in an urban setting. I think a lot of people, when they think about Native fiction, wouldn't picture putting it in a city like Oakland. But in the reading of the book, you realize that there is a huge community in urban centers, especially in Oakland.
It's not even necessarily especially in Oakland. It's all major cities in the country. Longest running Indian centers in the country is the Intertribal Friendship House in Oakland. They'll be celebrating their 65th anniversary in November. And this is, 65 years means generations of people who have been in cities. And to have no film depiction or literature depiction exist, or very few, very hard to find, and for there to be this ridiculous, monolithic depiction that everyone adheres to and everyone sort of believes in about what it means and looks like to be Native, it felt absurd to me, because there's long histories and many families and stories that just haven't been told. So this was part of what...
And so not only being your first book, but sort of taking on this burden of giving Native people a depiction that they haven't had in literature much, was that sort of an impressive burden on you as well? Did you feel the weight of that in your writing? Or were you sort of liberated by the idea of, like, oh, this is sort of fresh ground that no one's covered?
It was both. It was feeling like there was openness to do whatever I wanted because there was nothing to compare it to. And it was very lonely. Like, I don't know, when I was looking up Oakland authors, similarly, when I was looking up or thinking about or researching Native authors and the way that Native identity and experience is written about, there wasn't that much regarding city life and a lot of reservation stuff and a lot of historical stuff.
Do you ever, this is such a well-received first novel, does that sort of up the pressure for your next book? How are you feeling about that right now?
I'm feeling like I should just purposely write a bad book for the next one.
Like, totally tank the next one on purpose, yeah.
And then have a comeback for the third.
Yeah, that's really smart.
I'll be more like more... Nobody wants somebody to continue to succeed so well.
Yeah. Right now, everybody's really happy for you, but I feel like if the next one makes Obama's list, even, like, Obama would be a little mad at you. Mm-hmm. You're like, who's this guy making back-to-back lists?
I mean, has success been hard on you?
It's been very hard. Thank you for asking. I feel like nobody ever asks, and I really appreciate it. You, You went on writer's retreats when you were a young writer. I feel like there's a real romantic idea of like, oh, going away on a writer's retreat would be so much fun. Was it, did you find that rewarding?
Well, my first writer's retreat was not necessarily one that was like sanctioned by an organization. I just looked on Craigslist and found somebody who who looked like it was an artist community. And this is when you could trust Craigslist, and I got a a ride up there through Craigslist also.
And so on Craigslist, it was like, hey, writers, you want to come on up? Was that basically
there
it?
There were, like, pictures of fields, and, like, the language was very much like, this is conducive to artistic activity or whatever. And so I get up there, and my ride share takes off because
they're not a writer. They're not allowed to stay.
I was just paying them to ride up there. This is in Oregon, South Oregon, Southern Oregon. And I walk up to the front door and I see emblazoned in wood engraved fire, Jesus on the side of the door.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this is not an artist coming.
And, were you like, oh, Craigslist?
But I was raised evangelical Christian, so something felt sort of wrong and right about it at the same time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I spent that whole summer hiding in the room that I rented. And I was working 10 miles away in Ashland, Oregon for a New Age company who hired me. The guy hired me because I'm Native American, and he was being visited by an Indian in his dreams to bring back the ghost dance.
Oh, wow.
It was this whole crazy summer.
That worked out great for you.
I was being paid to ship out aura sprays and spiritual stones and New Age novels and CDs of Native American flutes and stuff like that.
You've come a long way, I think it's very safe to say. And thanks so much for making it here tonight. The book's fantastic. I really appreciate talking to you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Tommy Orange, everybody. They're available in paperback. We'll be right back.
This is Henry from Late Night. I'm here with Tommy Orange, author of They're There. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I love this book. I was telling you about this earlier. I read this book twice, and it just totally floored me that this was your debut. It's frustratingly good for a first time out of the gate. Really, really amazing. And I was reading a little bit about you, and it is amazing to me that you kind of had two tracks in life. You were either going to become a writer or a professional roller hockey player. Can you explain finding your way into that and then deciding you were going to take the writing track?
Yeah, I think it took a lot of undoing to finally decide about being a writer. It took a lot of undoing and I guess redoing the very idea of who I was, because I didn't grow up being encouraged academically or creatively in any way. I was good at sports. Like I knew I had good hand-eye coordination.
Yeah.
It maybe doesn't feel as promising as like being artistic naturally. Mm-hmm. It's like you can do stuff with your body. And so until I got into college, I didn't do anything other than sports as encouragement wise. And I got kicked out of high school, and you know, I didn't get good grades at all, and I didn't particularly care and didn't have a single conversation about college, like what's going to happen with college. There was no conversation. My parents raised me very religiously. Both sides, my dad, the Native religion, my mom, the Christian religion, both were just like, the most important thing in your whole life is to believe in God. And I was like, I don't.
You were not religious growing up.
Well, I was religious in the sense that I was afraid of the end of the world coming.
Sure, right.
And afraid of hell forever.
Uh-huh.
This is like the most base tactic to get somebody to believe in your religion is like, you will suffer for the entirety of eternity. Mm-hmm. If you don't believe in our thing. And I was like, I don't believe in it, but I'm going to do my best because I don't want to suffer for eternity.
Sure.
And both my parents are sort of like in similar veins of belief like that. Uh-huh. And so, you know, I found hockey and I was roller hockey and I was good at it. There was a professional team in Oakland.
Right.
And it seemed like a very clear, possible way for me to, for what I would do in my life. Mm-hmm. Roller hockey died on a beach in Southern California in the late 90s, when everyone realized rollerblading is super dorky.
Is that really what it was? They were like, this looks lame.
In retrospect, I think. But it also, at the time, the sport had moved from being in like the arena in Oakland, where like the Warriors play,
yeah.
or played now, unfortunately. Sure. to an outdoor arena where they wore short shorts that were super bright, hot colors. And it was just a joke at that point.
Yeah.
But it did coincide with people realizing rollerblading looks really dorky.
That's so funny.
I feel like everyone sort of woke up from some days of like being hypnotized by the spin of the wheels. Yeah, and it was oh, wait, this looks really bad. Because it died and it's never
returned. You don't hear about it anymore.
Nobody rollerblades.
Okay, so then you choose to become a writer. And you're writing your thesis. This is such an amazing thing to read about you. You're writing your thesis, and your keyboard does not have the letter G. Can you explain how that made you a better writer?
Yeah, so this was after I made the decision. I sort of felt like I had to choose between hockey and writing, and I chose writing. And I had friends that went on to play professionally in Europe. But I knew for sure that writing was it. And at some point, the G on my laptop broke off and did not work. And so it was just annoying at first. I didn't realize until deeply into not having a G that it was really making me question my ing endings of words, which are so related to passive writing. And this was something that I'd been told way early on in one of my first writing groups that I joined of random men in Santa Fe who totally tore me up for... They were like, all your writing's too passive. Don't write anymore. It was a very defeating writing group that I quit almost immediately. Brutal. But
not having like the gerund would force you to change that.
Yes. Yeah, so every ing ending would require me to copy and paste a pre-existing G from the document that I was working with, which is such an added step, annoying added step, that I really question, does this need to have an ing?
Yeah.
And, you know, I never... considered pacing or like that my novel was fast moving or whatever readable, but I got a lot of feedback afterward. And I almost think the reason is because of that G that I had to really consider.
I had a writing teacher in college who said one of the best things that can happen to you is losing your first draft. And she wrote some piece and she lost the first draft, and then she wrote a second draft and she only remembered the good parts, which made the second draft so much stronger because all the fat was kind of just filtered out.
Yeah.
You teach now, is that correct?
Yep.
So you did not kind of go through a traditional writing education, at least earlier in your life, or at least you weren't interested in it. How do you teach? What's your approach to it?
Well, I decided I wanted to write in 2005-ish, and I didn't get into the MFA till 2014. So this was all self-taught time where I was just like, this is what I want to do. People have been becoming writers since forever without MFAs. I was sort of anti-MFA. Uh-huh. But I found this particular native-focused MFA and peopled by students and faculty that were native. Mm-hmm. And it was intriguing to me, and it was affordable, and it was low residency, which means I didn't have to relocate my whole family. Right. You could do it remotely. Once I became a teacher, I was so newly a teacher and so recently a student, I felt my approach was sort of shaped by how I knew they would see me, which is like this brand new teacher. Obviously, you're not an experienced teacher. We know just graduated from this program. So my approach became a kind of deconstructing authority, and like something that I had to go through in the program was to, I feel like authority can compromise voice, like authentic voice in such real ways. So I wanted to find a way to teach in a way that questioned like what is good writing and who do you think can tell you what is good writing? And to immediately dismiss myself as any kind of authority and anybody else that they think is the authority, just question it. There's good tools to be put in a tool basket or case that you can use toward good writing, but don't let any particular writer be the definitive voice about your voice, because your voice is the only thing that can make you a writer. You know, there's nothing else that sets anybody else apart. We can all write like Hemingway and Carver and Amy Hempel and all the people that the MFA was designed around when it first started. Right. We can all aspire to be minimalists like that, or like show and don't tell everything. But voice does not come from adhering to something that has become gospel that really shouldn't be.
It's really good advice. Yeah, it's amazing to think about how the transition from student to teacher came so quickly. But still, kind of the lessons you're just talking about here seemed so much more helpful than so much of this traditional kind of educational writing path. That's so interesting. Well, thank you so much for being here. Again, the book is fantastic. It's really, really wonderful. I cannot wait for your next project. Congrats on an incredible debut. It's just wildly good.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for being here.
Appreciate it.
Late Night with Seth Meyers airs weeknights on NBC at 12:35, 11:35 Central. Original music on the Late Night podcast is by the HE Band. Don't forget to follow the handle Late Night Seth on social media and tell your friends to subscribe to the Late Night podcast wherever they get their podcasts.
Once upon a beat. Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. Once Upon a Beat.